You see, during this time of Imam's exile in Najaf, in other places, there were atrocities taking place in Iran, grand atrocities taking place in Iran, under the supervision of the SAVAK,
of course,
the secret police.
Which was set up by the CIA,
it was set up by the CIA,
Americans.
It had very strong links with Mossad. It actually had outhouses in Abadan and Khuzestan.
I think there's a point to be mentioned. It was Norman Schwarzkopf Sr., mm-hmm. who was the general of the one who took the Kuwait war. It was his father who actually set up the SAVAK here in Iran.
And consequently, SAVAK was continuously tracking down those people and those institutions who were keeping links with Imam.
Exactly.
So that kind of want to dismantle any people's revolt in favor of Imam Khomeini was continuously under, you could see some situations where drug dealers were allowed to have a free hand in Iran, but religious people did not have a free hand.
And the other thing was that, of course,
sorry to cut you, but even Shah's own sister was a major drug dealer here, Ashraf.
Oh, my
Ashraf
goodness.
Was a very major drug dealer.
Well, thank you for mentioning that, because that is really enlightens us about the nature of the Pahlavi regime.
There's a palace in
so
in,
she was running a cartel here.
Indeed, there's a palace in his land of palaces of the Shah, which was owned by Ashraf, and it was a den of enjoyment. You know, she had her own cinema hall there. She had her own bars and pubs and everything in that one. I mean, she was an evil woman, a twin sister of Shah. She was both in birth and both in nature.
Right.
So they were totally out to eliminate any line of connection with Imam Khomeini.
Right. Okay.
Throughout, you've got various ulema who were martyred, who were executed at the hands of Shah, SAVAK people, and not just ulema. You had ordinary people. That prison is kept as a museum now, where you go in and you could see all the atrocities, the tools
of
torture.
Yes, the political prisoners who were tortured to death.
What I'm trying to bring home to you here is this, that Imam Khomeini's supporters were not just left in peace because Imam Khomeini was in exile.
No.
They were continued because the Shah knew whilst Imam Khomeini was abroad, whilst his hopes were that he would die out, he knew that he wasn't dying out.
Yes.
And therefore, all these concepts of Hukumat Islami and all these roles of Islamic society were being continuously pumped into. And not only were they continuously being pumped into the people through cassettes and things like that, but the younger ulema of the Hauzas who were here, who were continuously being tortured or removed from their abilities to study or whatever. Like, for example, Imam Khamenei, he was taken from Mashhad and he was imprisoned in Iran Sher. They were transported here
Absolutely,
and there.
Absolutely, yes, of
So
course.
They were deprived from contact with the people. Yet still, having said that, the brave ulema of that time maintained whatever contact they could. And in relation to that contact, they would use the few minutes between the Salat to tell people what the real Islamic society should be. Whatever they could, they tried their utmost to make sure that the message of a true Islamic society under a leadership of Islam of an Islamic Alim ad-Din.
Shaheed Ayatollah Beheshti had a who was a mastermind in terms of networking in Iran. I mean, he was getting the tapes to places where even the regime couldn't even think of.
Exactly, and you see that's why between the time when Imam Khomeini reached Najaf and in 1978 when Saddam exiled him again, or he removed, he told him to leave.
Yeah, leave Iraq.
Leave Iraq. That Imam Khomeini's period of time over here proved to be both fruitful with relation to contact with Iranians and non-Iranian an Arab ulema.
Yeah.
It also provided that link of the ulema in Iran to keep links with the prominent alim, prominent scholar like Imam Khomeini.
Yes.
Because people would go for ziyarats to Najaf and they would come and kind of grab a message from Imam Khomeini to take to
and bring back to
bring
Iran.
Back. Yeah. So that kind of link of a center point of referral to religious matters, Imam Khomeini was maintaining that.
Yes.
Both in the sense of establishing that intellectual contact and also the economic contact.
Sure.
Because Imam Khomeini, what we discussed last time about the independence of the ulema, that Imam Khomeini, because he was collecting khums, was able to dictate the economy of the Shia community at that time.
Yes.
In the sense that he was providing funds.
Well, this also gives us a unique independence from the regime as well.
Indeed.
In order to carry out our religious functions.
Indeed, and you could see, again, another concept with the velayat of the faqih. We see that when a faqih wants to be applying God's commands, he has to have both the jurisdiction, jurisprudence in his hands and the economy in his hand.
Yes.
You You see, most of the fuqaha do not realize that they are natural wilayat faqis. Why?
Right.
Because they are both defining the jurisdiction through the fact that they are appointing judges, and then they have the economy through the khums. So in naturally, they're running an Islamic state.
They are.
But Imam Khomeini articulated that in a physical, applicable manner.
Yes.
And neglected the fact that because these people are just operating from the mosques and from their schools, that they are ignoring their responsibility. Imam Khomeini took his responsibility.
Of course.
He recognized his worth.
Yes.
And this is the subject of a tradition which Mawla Ali says in Najib Balagha.
Yes.
He says, he who does not know his worth is ruined. And Imam Khomeini recognized what he was worth.
Nice.
In the sense of the fact that he wanted to do what was Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala's command on him.
Well, I mean, I don't mean to digress here, but of course...
Sorry, I should mention the reference for it.
Yes.
It's saying number 149.
149.
In Najib Balagha.
Najib Balagha. I mean, thank you for that, Sayyidina, but the thing is that I don't mean to digress, but of course the success of Hezbollah in Lebanon was also the fact that there is a social duty to the people in terms of the function they carry out, because although we talked about the fact that there is Gnosism and there is the fact that we have to do the disciplining of our souls and all that, but it doesn't go without social duty. I mean, the social responsibility is the basis on which we practically carry out that Gnosis.
Indeed, and you see, and particularly you see the role of the ulama who were on Imam Khomeini's line.
Yeah.
They were collecting khums on behalf of Imam Khomeini, and they were distributing to the needy people of and applying the rules of the khum.
While the Pahlavi regime, as you say, was in affluence and enjoying the luxuries of the public treasury, the people were poor. I mean, there was a horrendous poverty here in Iran.
Indeed they were. And that's where the message got through to people.
Yeah.
And you see, then we just look at the period of his exile, when the Shah puts pressure on it proves now that the enemy of the hatred of Saddam towards Iran was not because he hated Iranians, not because he had anything, but the fact that he became a tool to prevent the Islamic revolution from succeeding later on.
Yeah.
Because Saddam and Shah got together to remove Imam Khomeini from Najaf.
Right.
You know, on the continuous desire that Imam Khomeini does not remain in Iraq to be a pressure on Shah, so he wanted to reduce that pressure. So he tells Imam Khomeini that he must leave.
Right.
Imam Khomeini in 1978, when he's leaving, he first lands in Kuwait, where he decides...
Where he was refused at the border, I believe.
He was refused entry, and thereupon he then went off to France.
Yeah.
But what's really interesting is that when Imam Khomeini is deciding to reach France, of course he's also thinking of going to Syria and Libya, the governments over there are put under pressure by Iran not to take Imam Khomeini there.
Right.
And he doesn't. He ends up, and that this again is the destiny that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala wanted to create for the Islamic movement because it became an international voice then.
Yeah.
And particularly from France, that the message became even more outburst. The outbursts were even more firmer and want for removal.
I mean, it's a beautiful thing that, you know, when you put this thing together, that you see Imam Khomeini ending up in France, and France became a revolutionary movement for Europe 200 years earlier. It's almost like, you know, the two things are coming together, that an Islamic revolution, which is going to revolutionize the Muslim world, comes out of the background and the backdrop of a country that was revolutionary for Europe.
Yeah, I mean, it's a fact that, but still, there were people in France who were not happy for Imam Khomeini to be there.
Sure.
Shah was maneuvering more
often. Of course,
often.
I mean, he was getting desperate.
I mean, to extend, there's some documents which have been released which prove that there was an aspiration by Shah that somehow Imam Khomeini should be eliminated in France.
Ah, right. And so that was one of the other motives to send him there.
So
yeah.
But they were unable to do so.
So
and particularly when Imam Khomeini's message became more and more apparent to the Western media and other institutions, sometimes they tried to make the movement look too classic, too pre-time type of thing, that it would not have application in the 20th century.
I think this is another thing. This is very important, that, you know, how Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala somehow blinds the enemy because they really underestimated what Imam Khomeini was about, and even his movement at that time was not understood at all, that what exactly was happening from the Nouveau Chateau in outside Paris. They had no clue. I mean, even the Americans were completely bamboozled at what Ayatollah meant and what consequences it had.
Communities, Imam Khomeini worked from different angles. Yeah. You know, there's a beautiful story about Christmas when Imam Khomeini was there.
Right.
And Imam Khomeini sends somebody to take a flower and give Christmas greetings to all the neighbors.
My goodness.
You know, so they just didn't understand. You know, for a while they didn't know who this black turban man was, but then suddenly they realized that he has humanly characteristics.
Yes.
Not what like the media or people are trying to suggest, that these people are going to topple the Shah or they're going to create a...
And of course he's celebrating the occasion of another great prophet exactly. Jesus, peace be upon him, son of Mary.
The whole thing, I mean, even now there are a lot of people in that area in Paris who remember Imam Khomeini for this particular... Yeah. A gesture of his.
I think there's another important point to be mentioned in the third phase of this very important Islamic movement. We've talked about, you know, the concept of the Walaya. We've talked about the movement of the people. But the most important thing was that the Shah had a very powerful army here in Iran. I mean, it was one of the strongest in the region. And it was a very powerful instrument. And Imam Khomeini very cleverly disarmed the army by just simply saying, well, it's only a few officers at the top who need to be dealt with, but the rest of the army, he said, are from the people. Yeah. They are Muslim.
You see, this is where you're kind of drifting into a very important area of the third phase, which is the initiation of the revolution.
Yeah.
Because once Imam Khomeini did, you know, the exile of Imam Khomeini was finishing in the late 70s, in 78, 79, when 79 he comes
because
back in Iran.
I mean, this aspect, you know, I'm pointing out with the army was in the sense that the Shah was relying on this very important tool, and so were the Americans, that they would be able to suppress the people's movement. And we're kind of seeing that 30 years on, you know, even with Egypt, you know, that, you know, the military junta is very difficult to remove. You know, they're very difficult to placate unless you can deal with them right from the outset. And Imam Khomeini does that beautifully.
See,
I mean,
Imam Khomeini did this through this continuous indoctrination of the truth.
That's right.
You see, in the Egyptian arena, you do not have ulema who are guiding the forces even.
I'm thinking particularly of Ayatollah Rafsanjani, you know, although he's at that time he was Hujjatul Islam Rafsanjani, but at that time he was doing a lot of this kind of work, you know, to get the message across to the ordinary soldier, you know, that, you know,
and you see
about Islam.
These messages which were coming from the cassettes, they were messages of very fierce messages denouncing the Shah. I mean, they were talking about the American serpents, you know, the fact
that
the Americans were eating away at your forces, you know, your forces can't do anything without the authority of an American soldier even.
That's
you know,
right.
Your planes sit waiting for a nut to be delivered from America, and until that nut is delivered, that plane
That's
cannot
right.
take
that,
off.
Your
Air Force people can't touch planes without the authority of a senior American pilot. So, you know, everything was coming home to some soldiers. And
they were completely humiliated
and, you know,
by
when
the
Imam
Americans.
Khomeini gave his message in Bejt al-Zahra, he said, you know, you as soldiers, you're part of us.
That's
Do you
right.
want to remain subservient to a
foreign
power?
Army that debases you?
So Imam Khomeini is throughout the time bringing back self-respect.
Yes.
For the Iranian soldiers.
Exactly.
Self-respect and making them realize that when they open fire on a demonstrator, he's another one of his own Ahlul Bayt supporters.
Yes. You know, and he's also saying, are you opening your fire on your own mother and father, on your own parents,
family?
So
he's bringing this continuous realization, so much so that when the revolution does take place, the very first strong force of support that is given to Imam Khomeini was the Air Force.
Exactly. Exactly.
You know, immediately the Air Force gives that allegiance to Imam Khomeini. Mm. And you see, you could see that the continuation of pressure on the society by the society against the Shah was too much for the Shah to handle.
Exactly.
You know, I mean, what really broke the camel's back, straw that broke the camel's back, was the fact that on Ashura, Shah takes a helicopter and flies over the demonstrations, and he sees that there's no empty space there for him to see land, so as to say. You know, it's just waves of people. Shout, what were they shouting? because
Marbar Shah,
death to Shah. So I mean, what was left for him?
Nothing.
So in reality, Imam Khomeini had instigated this whole movement of animosity towards he who was a puppet of the most powerful nation of the world.
Yeah.
Yet it could not protect its own puppet in its own in the country that it had planted in. Then that movement, once Shah did get toppled, America didn't stop.
No.
America didn't stop and say, okay, Shah's gone, let's try and negotiate or see what we can do with this new government. They started instigating anti-revolutionary activities in Iran.
That was the next phase of their plan. Of course, they have a backup, don't they? They always do that.
You see, this was that continuation of that final phase of Imam Khomeini's.
They started to rely on the secular elements to come to the fore, whether they were communist or something
Indeed.
Else. It didn't matter.
No. And they tried to instigate these evil people, not through just Shapur Bakhtiar, but then other the coups that they tried to create in Iran. One of the major coups that they created in Iran was the election of Bani Sadr.
That's right.
That was a very major coup that they were trying to instigate.
Yes.
By planting an individual who later proved to be the backbone to backbone which enabled Saddam's army to come so far into
Iran.
Iran in 1981.
Yeah, yeah.
So you could see Imam Khomeini was forced. There was a very major element of foresight in Imam Khomeini's thinking.
Of course.
Of how, I mean, he makes a lot of statements when these corrupt elements were trying to penetrate, telling people to open up their eyes, see the reality of what people
but
are offering.
In a sense, Imam Khomeini was so astute in that situation because, first of all, he kept the army intact, which, of course, he anticipated that the Americans were going to cause all kinds of grievances from north to south of Iran. And because many commanders even now say 30 years on that thanks to Imam Khomeini keeping the army intact, we were able to put the situation under control. And, you know, these things couldn't get out of hand, you know, to show that there was complete chaos in the system.
Indeed. And you see, on the back of freedom of speech, these elements tried to confront.
They were trying to hijack the revolution.
Not only just hijack, but also insult the whole meaning of Islamic society.
Exactly.
And that's why Imam Khomeini left it to the referendum, where 98.2% who voted in favor of Islamic government.
And there was no say in that.
Were options there. There were options of Republic of Iran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or just some other terminology
and
where nationalism
comes out and says, no, I want Islamic Jamhuriya.
Exactly. So the Islamic Republic must be the concept that we go for.
Because
and that's what people went for.
Yeah.
And this is what these ignorant politicians don't understand, that a Muslim society, as much as how evil you may try to endeavor to make it, there is a heartfelt desire to be a Muslim.
Exactly.
Even in Turkey, with all the corruption and everything, you see, ordinary people want Islamicness for themselves.
That's right, and they vote for Islamic parties inside Turkey.
Exactly. Yeah. So you could see that aspiration to be Islamic society. Mm. Imam Khomeini had touched the most depth of this feeling. The whole thing that Imam Khomeini defined for people when he disapproved of Shapur Bakhtiar was that this Shapur Bakhtiar had zero knowledge of Islamic values.
That's right.
How could he possibly be an authority in an Islamic society? Consequently, the only person who could provide some type of Islamic guidance to an Islamic society would be a jurisprudence who has the awareness of how Islamic rules can be interpreted for social necessities.
Yes. And because for the ordinary Muslim, it has to be emphasized, for the ordinary Muslim, particularly in the school of Ahlul Bayt, he needs to give his allegiance to an authority, a marja'i, a taqlid, as they say, an authority to give his allegiance to in order for his salah, for his hummus, for his all his religious duties and rights to be validated in the sight of God.
Well, validated in the sense that to make sure that they're rightfully performed.
Rightfully performed, yes.
In the right manner, rather than the validity of it.
Of course.
One is not saying that these people would give some sort of stamp of approval for prayers performed.
But
just to make sure,
as you quite rightly say,
they're performed in the right order, in the right manner, in the means by which they would be recognized as performed duties.
Exactly.
So, but you see, this is the other point that you're making, which is quite interesting, is that a faqih's responsibility is not just to legitimize or legalize worship.
No.
But in fact, the faqih is defining every act of the individual as a worship
yes,
for God.
Yes, yes, yes.
Even to the extent that, as I said earlier on, he goes to make an earning for his children, he's doing worship.
That's right.
You see?
Yes.
And therefore, what becomes even more of a responsibility of worship is he who takes on the authority to rule his community, he should recognize this as a worship. And the only time you recognize it as a worship is when you have God in your sight. And that's why Imam Khomeini said in one of his lectures.
It totally defines politics in a completely different
And that's why Imam Khomeini
status.
Says establishing Islamic hukumat is more important than salat.
Yeah.
He's not announcing kufr here.
No.
What he's saying is he who establishes Islamic hukumat will be an automatic defender of salat.
Exactly.
But he who just does salat does not necessarily have the feeling to establish Islamic government.
Exactly.
You have so many people in lines in Mecca and Medina doing salat, but they don't even have the iota knowledge of how Islamic government should be established. So he who has any mind of establishing Islamic government would have only a mind to establish Islamic government if he sees himself as subservient to the Creator. Subservience to the Creator automatically demands that the individual is a one who performs salat, who performs hajj, who performs gives zakat. So in other words, all aspects of worship are automatically performed by this individual as one who's striving to establish Islamic government.
And this is where Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, mentions in one speech where he says, well, you know, establishing Islamic government leaves no room for any depraved regime to have any role in such a country. I mean, people like Bakhtiar were automatically unemployed because there's no room for them in such a system.
Bani Sadr had zero Islamic values.
Exactly.
I mean, he dresses like a woman to escape from Iran a chadar because of the fact that he...
quite rightly so.
He doesn't recognize in general Islamic rule it's haram for a male to wear women's clothes.
Well, there you go. But it's such a humiliating exit.
What I'm trying to say is that these people who have zero or very little knowledge of Islam, how can they possibly advocate to be the heads of Islamic society? Yeah.
But Imam Khomeini makes that clear now.
Imam Khomeini makes that clear. Yeah. And particularly when he makes it, when a lot of the scholars and students have said that whenever Imam Khomeini talked about anything, he would link that conversation to God.
Exactly.
Everything, you know, if somebody came to him and said, this food is really delicious, he would say, for example, if God did not create the ability for you to taste goodness, you would not have tasted the flavor of this food, for example. You know, he would just take all the conversation to
and
God.
And I think that, just to summarize in the last 30 seconds of the program today, and I thank you, Sayyidina, it was a great contribution there. But in the last 30 seconds, that's what we're talking about at the end of the day, that a proper Islamic republic is really about people being brought near to God.
Indeed.
And in the proper way. And that's what we're talking about.
Indeed. And
it?
Particularly at the hands of he who is able to interpret God's
law before them in the most competent and in the right manner. So thank you very much, Sayyidina. That was really great today. And in the next sessions, we hope to go in more depth about the impact of what Imam Khomeini, may God bless his great soul, has made on the world in terms of the movements that we are now seeing. But that will be discussed, of course, in later programs. But right now, thank you very much for your participation on the program. And thank you, listeners, for listening today. Wa assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. May the peace and blessings and mercy of Allah be upon you all. Thank you and goodbye.
The last message of the late Imam.
وصیت من به همه آن است که با یاد خدای متعال به سوی خودشناسی و خودکفایی و استقلال با همه ابعادش به پیش و بی تردید دست خدا با شما. اگر شما
My advice to all is to advance towards self-awareness, self-sufficiency and independence with the remembrance of Almighty God. Without any doubt, His hand is with you if you be with Him and continue with this spirit cooperation for the advancement of the Islamic country.
به اعقاب ملت منتقل شود و نسلا بعد نسل بر اون افزوده گردد با دلی آرام و قلبی مطمئن و روحی شاد.
I pray that all that I see in the noble nation of alertness, intelligence, commitment, devotion, spirit of resistance and courage being employed in the path of Allah shall by his grace be transmitted to the successive future generations with increased momentum. With a peaceful mind, a certain heart, a happy soul, and a conscience hopeful for Allah's mercy, I take my leave of all brothers and sisters. I need your prayers, and I beseech Almighty God's pardon and forgiveness for my inadequacies and my faults. I hope the nation, too, will forgive my shortcomings and failings. Move ahead with power and determination, and know that the departure of one servant shall not leave a scratch on the steel shield that is the nation. Worthier servants of greater stature are in service, and Allah preserves the nation and the oppressed people of the world.
Cultural news, social news, scientific news, artistic news, with delight.
Chinese students receive a science lesson on their country's space station, and they are lucky enough to receive it firsthand from the astronauts living in the first and core module of the station. The class was held via a live broadcast shown on the state television. The three astronauts gave a lecture that focused on physics. They explained how the weightlessness environment affects the movement of objects. The astronauts also gave a tour of the station they arrived at in October for a six-month stay. It seems that their teachings were quite motivating. The students peppered their instructors with questions, including those about living conditions in space. China launched its space station in April and plans to complete it by the end of the next year. Christmas is just around the corner, and children are waiting for their presents. In Guatemala, Santa Claus has a new mode of transport to give gifts to children with cancer.
Today, as in the past year, we are celebrating Christmas with the cancer patients of the shelter. Santa Claus came in a helicopter to give presents to the children. It is very emotional for the children. The majority of them have never been so close to a helicopter, let alone Santa Claus.
That was an exciting experience for the children. The charity event was organized by an institute that supports cancer patients for remote areas in Guatemala. The institute says the event aimed to help the children go through their therapies with more ease. The Amazon River turtles are in danger of extinction, but environmentalists have come up with an initiative to save their lives, and that's by protecting their eggs. Climate change and human activities against their ecosystem have been putting these creatures at risk. Now, what the biologists and local volunteers do is that they recover the turtle nests from riverbanks during the rainy season to protect them from drowning. Then they take care of the baby turtles until they develop a hard shell and are ready to start their life journey. Batches of tiny turtles release into a river in the Amazon border between Bolivia and Brazil. They are now grown enough to protect themselves against different threats. Environmentalists have been doing this for more than 20 years, saving millions of baby turtles. This time they released 1 million of the little turtles. During the Christmas season, people around the world love to add a dose of joy in the form of Santas. Children especially feel ecstatic to see Santas distributing presents and snacks. But you will be amazed to see how one Santa this time dives into water to give well-behaved sharks and fishes their goodies. In Malta's National Aquarium, Scuba Claus, helped by an elf, plunges into a huge fish tank with his sack of treats to feed sharks and fishes. Santa's ho 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 come out in bubble from through his snorkel over his white beard. The aquarium, located in the northern part of the island, hosts more than 175 different species of various marine animals.
Butterflies are probably the most popular among all insect species on Earth due to their beauty and color. Millions of monarch butterflies have flocked to a Mexican forest, creating a magical sight, drawing tourists, scientists, and locals there. The monarch butterflies flee the cold winters of Canada and northern United States and travel thousands of kilometers to hibernate and reproduce in the temperate woods of central Mexico. Hundreds of trees crowded with butterflies can be seen along Mexico's 13,000-hectare monarch reserve after their long journey. However, experts warn of a drop in the number of the species. Climate change is reported to have had an impact on their butterflies' migration pattern, as well as a reduction in their milkweed breeding habitat in the United States.
With the Christmas season in full swing, hundreds have gathered on Spain's Gran Canaria island to watch stunning sand sculptures representing the birth of Christ. 8 sand artists from around the world have created the spectacular figures. It took them a week to complete the scenes. A huge sand wall is built around the sculptures to protect them. The island has been holding the event every year since 2006. The warm temperatures on the Spanish beach have helped attract a lot of visitors over Christmas. According to the organizers, at least 200,000 people have visited the exhibition in the past 15 years. A joyful day at an Australian zoo as a baby pygmy hippo is born. That's good news for the zoo staff because pygmy hippos are endangered species. Cambiri, the mother hippo, gave birth to the calf last month. It's her second calf, and the first one was born in a Sydney zoo 4 years ago. The newborn is yet to be named. It sticks to the mum and follows her wherever she goes. The calf is spending most of its time out of the sight of the public, as for now it's learning to walk and swim. And the mum keeps a close eye on the calf at all times.
The first few days, she did not leave the calf's side, was very sedate, very quiet, and just looking after its every need. And only in the last sort of couple of days has she started to get a little bit more sleep in.
They are regarded as endangered animals because of illegal hunting and loss of habitat. Currently, less than 3,000 pygmy hippos are living in the wild.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
Is it interesting to experience what Harry Potter went through at Hogwarts? Well, it could be, at least for students at a university in Pakistan, kicking off a festival celebrating the fictional wizard. The students at Government College University made their 150-year-old campus look like the magical school created by British author J.K. Rowling. They put on costumes and set up decorations reminiscent of Hogwarts. The university's vice chancellor says the campus, with its vast halls and soaring archways, has always reminded the students of the fictional school.
Most of these youngsters, they grew up at the time when J.K. Rowling's work was being presented in the novels and then later on in the film. So that magical charm, that fantasy, they really enjoyed. They grew up reading that fantasy. And then when they come to Government College University and see these architecture, it reminds me of that Hogwarts that is being filmed in Harry Potter films.
The university officials spoke proudly of what his students have done. They were themselves happy too, calling their experience fun. Others said it was unbelievable to be in Hogwarts. The festival also screened Pakistan's first fan-made Harry Potter film, made and acted by the students. The Swedish city of Stockholm has launched its 31st annual Christmas competition of baking gingerbread.
There is a limited in space, so it's 40 centimeters by 40 centimeters, and everything you build, all the material, need to be eatable. So you can build with different things, gingerbread, of course, but also candies and other things, but you need to be able to eat it. So that's one of the rules as well.
Each year, the Gingerbread House competition, hosted by ArcDesk Museum of Architecture and Design, has a theme for the designs. This year's theme is Together, attracting various interpretations of the topic. So far, the entries have included the Titanic, the famous coffee shop from the American TV show Friends, an igloo, and the Berlin Wall, all entirely edible. The event, which has been running for 31 years, is designed for all kinds of creators, such as children, young people, adults, amateurs, and professionals. The Tasty exhibition runs until January the 5th. A Palestinian teacher has developed an assistant for himself nicknamed Mr. Robot, bringing joy to the children of a school in Gaza. Mr. Robot teaches the children of Al-Basma School about electric circuits and helps them memorize their lessons. Mr. Robot moves freely in the classroom, speaking Arabic to students and communicating with them as a friend. The teacher creating it says the aim was to stimulate creativity and innovation in his classroom.
Mr. Robot, as his name suggests, is the teacher's assistant and not his replacement. He assists in the education process by asking questions and giving answers, greeting students and interacting with them in all aspects of a class.
The teacher says at first students reacted to it in a strange way, but later on they said it was like a dream come true for them. Local engineers say the robot is the first of its kind in the Gaza Strip, where electrical tools and components are scarce.
Artificial intelligence has found its way into several aspects of our lives. Now, a French research team is working on a project to provide fishermen with intelligent trawls that could help them sort out fishes before they are brought to the boats.
The objective of the project is to try to provide a support tool for fishermen, because at the moment, when they put their fishing gear in the water, a trawl net is like a large net. It is towed behind the vessel for several hours without having knowledge of what enters the trawl net in real time. Namely, is it species that are targeted by the fishermen or not targeted?
The trawl has a camera that can capture footage underwater, which is then analyzed by a microcomputer using artificial intelligence. If targeted fishes are detected, the trawl will switch to fishing mode, but when there are no targeted species, it will switch back to flight mode to avoid having an impact on the seabed. Another feature of this technology is to identify and classify pelagic species. For instance, horse mackerel can be displayed in blue on the screen, while the sardines are shown in pink. you enjoy nighttime adventures, then this park in Paris is just for you. Decorated with colorful lighting, the venue gives you a real feeling of life-size sculptures depicting dinosaurs and other prehistoric animals. In this exhibition dubbed Evolution on the Path of Lights, visitors can walk through tunnels formed by some of the sculptors. They are made of paper, steel, and lights. More than 100 sculptors light up like lanterns across the park. These include well-known favorites of kids, such as Triceratops and T-Rex. Some huge lanterns also represent insects and vertebrates that walked on the planet millions of years ago. The exhibition's director says the goal is to raise awareness and educate the public about biodiversity in the past and present.
In Thailand, monkeys climbing on piles of fruits and vegetables in central Thailand is not due to a mess, though. It is actually an annual event called the Monkey Festival in Lopburi Province. The long-tailed monkeys, known as macaques, feast on 2 tons of fruits and vegetables in Lopburi. That is the capital city of the province with the same name. Locals say the event is a symbolic way to thank the cute animals for doing their part in drawing tourists to their town. This year's festival took place after a 2-year halt due to the pandemic.
Today is the 33rd time that we held this event. This year under the theme of Wheelchair Monkey Party, where we organizers will donate 100 wheelchairs to people in need. I would say the event is very successful. Many Thais and tourists are visiting.
Lopburi has been holding the annual festival for its monkey population for decades now. COVID restrictions meant last year's party was missing its usual crowd of spectators. However, this year the humans were back in force with more than 100 turning out to see the monkeys. Historical monuments have many duplicates made by enthusiasts around the world. India's Taj Mahal is not an exception. But the one you're about to see right now is not just a physical copy. It shares the spirit of Taj Mahal as well. This mini replica is located in the city of Burhanpur, some 800 kilometers away from the magnificent Taj Mahal itself. It has a love story behind it too, just as Taj Mahal does. Anand Parkash Choksi, a teacher, has built this replica as a gift to his spouse. It took Choksi 3 years to build the 4-bedroom house that is decorated by artisans from Agra, where Taj Mahal is located. He says that he has made the replica to show his love and spread the message of peace. Taj Mahal was built by a Mughal Emperor Shah Jahan in memory of his wife Mumtaz Mahal, back in the 17th century.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuhu, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is your host, Musa al-Bahalali, and you are now listening to the program Q&A on Islamic Beliefs. Joining us in the studio is a dear friend and esteemed guest, Sheikh Nur Muhammad, who is an Islamic researcher at the Seminary of Qum. Dear Sheikh, I welcome you and assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. I'm glad to be here.
Thank you for joining us, dear Sheikh, because today we have an interesting and tough and difficult question for you. According to a narration narrated from or attributed to Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam, the 5th Shia Imam,
yes,
he says that the groomsman, when he is going forth to engage a woman,
He must see the woman that he is going to be engaged to, because he is buying at a very expensive price a woman. So the question that is very obvious here, did the Imam just say that you can buy women? Can you buy women in Islam?
Yes. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. You see that again, here is kind of misunderstanding of narrations of Ahlul Bayt and pure progeny of Noble Prophet Muhammad. When we want to analyze some narrations, we have to have some certain qualification here. Right. Maybe it is somehow, to some extent, difficult for some ordinary people to go directly to the narrations of Ahlul Bayt and try to understand some of the narrations.
Of course.
And go to the first-hand sources of, for example, narrations and hadith corpus. Because of that, we need some mujtahid who
is
qualified. We have
tafsir of riwayat,
yes,
for example.
Because of that, we say that you have to go to the qualified mujtahid, which means the person who is has all qualification for understanding.
Right. A scholar, an expert.
Expert and a scholar in Islamic studies, and ask those people to explain for you the narrations of Ahlul Bayt alayhi salatu wassalam. Talking about this issue, let me give you a perspective of Islamic law in this regard.
Right.
We say that it is forbidden to look at women lustfully.
Yes.
This is a first Islamic law.
Unless she's your wife, of course.
Of course. It is forbidden to look at, to have lustful look to non-mahram women. Of course, it is clear that we are not talking about the wives. And because of the verse of Noble Quran, أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم قل للمؤمنين يغضوا من أبصارهم. Tell the faithful men to cast down their looks and to guard the private part to be looked at. Of course, this is the addition for the this narration. I mean, my explanation for the translation of this verse. That is more decent for them. And of course, for the next verse talking about women, actually ask women not to have lustful look at the opposite gender. This is a first Islamic laws. But we have some exception here. And one of the exception here is looking at a woman that you want to propose to her.
Right, looking at a woman with the intention to marry her.
With the intention to marry her. Yes. Of course, again, the it should not be, it must not be in lustful way again.
Right.
But as a look to test
to
that
determine
woman.
Determine, do you like her face,
do you
how
like,
she looks?
Yes, all.
Because physical attraction, it is important at the end of the day.
Of course,
we cannot
very
deny
important,
that.
Yeah. If you, because you want to get married to that woman,
right.
you have to choose her as your future wife,
right.
And so on and so forth. In this context, Imam alayhi salatu wasalam, he said that it has been quoted from Imam al-Baqir, سَأَلْتُ أَبَا جَعْفَرَ عَلَيْهِ السَّلَامِ أَنِ الرَّجُلُ يُرِيدُ أَنْ يَتَزَوَّجَ الْمَرْأَ أَيَنْدُرُ إِلَيْهَا. I went to Muhammad ibn Muslim, one of the narrators, companions of Imam al-Baqir. He said that I want to, for example, suppose that I want to get married to that woman. Am I allowed to look at that particular girl that I want to
I go in blind? I know nothing, I just get married.
Yes. Imam said that Naam innama yashtariha bi aghla thaman. Yes, of course. Because you want to get married to that woman and you want to spend money. This yashtariha bi aghla thaman literally means literal translation means you want to buy her with the expensive money.
Right.
But this is metaphoric. For those people who are familiar with the Arabic literature, they easily understand this is metaphor.
Many metaphors in the Arabic language.
Yes, of course. Yeah. But the question understood it in a literal meaning, and because of this misunderstanding.
Because it got translated also literally, so there's a problem.
Yeah, because you want to spend money. You want to, it's kind of, you want to, for example, give dowry.
Right.
And it's, and the
so
nafaka.
Many expenditures.
Not so many, because in Islam, in Islamic family, nafaka of woman, which means sustenance of woman, clothing, for example, house and feeding, these kind of things, which are usual and anybody needs it.
Of course,
it is upon the shoulder of the man, not woman. Financial responsibility. Women in Islam, wives in Islam, does not have financial responsibility.
Right.
All these responsibilities, financially speaking, goes to men. You know, because of this, another narration, he said that في رجل يندر إلى محاسن المرأة يريد أن يتزوجها. Again, another narration. I want to get married to that woman. Can I look at her? In order to analyze her and understand whether I like that.
The word used here is mahasin,
yes,
which means, dear Sheikh.
Yes, mahasin, the beauties.
Exactly, and this is very important point. He can look at her attractive traits.
Yes, of course. Of course, that person, as I said, in not in lustful way, but in a look that you want to test that whether.
Yes, do I want to be with her or not?
Yes.
Do not come with this lust already in you. No. You come to see.
Yes, of course, only. Different. It has been, of course, you should go to your own scholars and ask them. But generally speaking, right. Yes, more than her, you can look at her body too, yes, because you want to get married to that particular.
We will have narrations on this matter, but for fear of short of time, we will neglect these narrations.
Yes.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs on IRIB English Radio. You can send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
Is it? قال لا بس إنما هو مستام. No problem, you can look at her because it is a kind of treatment. You want to, it's kind of trade. Again, this trade, okay, this it is metaphor here,
right.
And you cannot translate it in a literal meaning.
Right.
Yes.
And to highlight this, if our dear listeners would imagine, for example, you are shopping. Online shopping, which is very popular these days, and you want to buy, for example, a phone.
Exactly.
You want to see this phone. You want to go and hold this phone. You want to see what are the qualifications.
Absolutely.
Before you buy it. And the more expensive it is, the more that you are going to go analyze it, ask about this phone, go to the experts, see it with your own eyes. Do you like it? Do you not like it?
Yes.
And that's the metaphor here. The woman, of course, she's not a product. She's not aware. But the process applies.
Exactly.
And vice versa, because the woman also have these rights on the man.
Alhamdulillah. Very good explanation you mentioned here. And Imam alayhi salatu wasalam exactly wanted to mention this point.
Right.
Because whenever you want to go and to buy something, okay, you check it. Whether
exactly.
It is, has the qualification that
it's
you're
only
looking
logical.
For or not.
If you don't, people call you stupid.
Yes, exactly.
Right.
And because of that, and the marriage is more greater and more important than buying, for example, simple things.
It is the most holy foundation and relationship in Islam.
Yes, of course. And because of that, you're allowed to look at some part of the body of that individual. Yes.
Is the hair allowed to be looked at?
Yes, of course. As I said, look at the hair of that girl and some other part of the, you know, some part of the body of that woman, you can look at it. But again, I have to mention this point that you should go to your scholars because
there's a difference.
Yeah, because we are explaining some of the Islamic laws here,
right.
But you have to go to your marja and the grand marja and ask them to give you Islamic rules.
So, dear Sheikh, we mentioned that you can look at some body parts of the woman. I know certainly a lot of Muslims will be shocked to hear that when that a groomsman is allowed, a prospect is coming to, for example, marry your daughter, he is allowed to look at her hair. So how are the conditions for this to happen?
Of course, the rational condition is to be this kind of looking should be under the, under the control of parents, okay?
Right.
Under the, you know, care of the parent, they should look at this situation. course. Not you cannot go, you know, for example, in a go to the personal things of that girl. I mean, in the private session, okay?
Right. Yeah.
It should be, it is recommended to be under the care of the parents
to
and
avoid
under the
anything
supervision
happening.
Of them. Yes, right. Under the supervision of parents. But generally speaking, it is allowed to look at the some part of the body of that woman because it is
which
rationally
part
accepted.
Is it, dear Sheikh? Because we need to be very specific because unfortunately a huge part of our Islamic society, again, unfortunately, they have ignored or seemingly forgotten these rules and these Islamic rulings for how you should go and engage, you should go and marry somebody. Because if you go now and tell some Muslim father that, yes, this groomsman, he may look at your daughter without a hijab, he will flip out.
Yes.
Right, dear Sheikh?
You're right, but I want to say that it has some condition within it.
Right.
And the condition is that there is a great possibility that you're going to get married with that girl.
Of course, yeah. If you're coming to their house officially with your father or with your mother,
yes.
It is, of course.
And there is no hindrance for getting married, okay? There
right.
is no hindrance for that. And this great possibility that you're going to do this marriage. But of course, maybe some other condition for that. But generally
right.
speaking, you are allowed, and this is rationally accepted because had
it is normal in every society, dear Sheikh. But something happened in the minds of the Muslims. Even though Islam says to do this, nobody does it.
Yes, maybe you know the culture of some Muslim maybe differ from this Islamic ruling.
Yeah.
Maybe yes, you're
especially
right.
Especially about marriage, because it has turned to something completely else now.
Yes, yeah, but and because of that, unfortunately, sometimes we have maybe some divorce because they did
right.
not have this condition. They
there
did
were
not
no
observe.
Compatibility, and we've seen this many times.
Yeah,
many,
yeah.
Many times, unfortunately.
But if you practice Islamic laws and to try to implement these Islamic
right.
laws, maybe inshallah, for sure, we will have less divorce and less family problems
right.
within the structure of family in Islamic society.
And keeping that in mind, we will have to end today's program because we are out of time. I thank the dear Sheikh for clearing up this huge problem and difficult question. I also thank the dear listeners for sticking throughout with us and tuning in. Fi amanillah.
Inna fil jannati nahran laban. Inna fil jannati nahran laban. Ali. حسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين كل من كان محبا لهم كل من كان محبا لهم يدخل الجنة من غير حزن يدخل الجنة من غير حزن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.